The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Obedient anchors on state TV never question the Kremlin's version of facts and reinforce its tropes about denazification. No mention that President Zelensky is Jewish or Russian missiles killed civilians near a Holocaust memorial in Kyiv. Even so, some mostly younger Russians see through their government's lies, get their news from friends, independent and social media.
I think this is a crime, an aggression against a neighboring country. Our government invaded, now they are killing people.
The government is so worried independent media could challenge their narrative. In the past few days, it shut down two outlets and is right now preparing a law that would criminalize what it calls fake media.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good afternoon, friends. Welcome back. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. We have a whole range of topics that we'll be discussing today. We're going to talk about the movies. We're going to talk about the economy. We'll talk a little bit about the impact of assisted suicide. Right now, however, we are going to focus on Ukraine, the crisis in Ukraine, what's going on there. And joining us to discuss that with us is Dr. Ivan Jankovic. He's a Serbian-born economist and political philosopher teaching at the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. And he studies price theory, industrial organization, history of economic thought, and political theory. And Dr. Jankovic, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, and Dr. Jankovic, I think that we've all had a crash course, right, over the last couple of weeks of some of the history between Russia and Ukraine. We have had a lot more focus on this. We saw some of this in 2014, and it's been in the news. So, I mean, I think we're at least cognizant of the issues here. What is it that we're missing in this right now? And how did how do you get a war in Europe in the 21st century after a bloody century of conflict on that continent?
What we are missing, I believe, or what a large chunk of Western public opinion was missing before this began was ignoring the true nature and character of Putin's regime.
Yes.
Whoever wanted to see with their eyes could have seen in 2008 or in 2014 at the very latest that this moment will come. Eastern European politicians and Russian opposition leaders and dissidents were warning people like Garry Kasparov, ex-world chess champion, or Vladimir Karamurza, or Boris Nemtsov, who was shot and killed in the front of Kremlin like 7 years ago. All of them were adamant in their claims that if Putin was not stopped at the early stage of his aggression of Ukraine, something like this very well might happen. That the Ukraine will be next, and not just the eastern part of Ukraine, the whole of Ukraine. So that's, we are now in for a rude awakening, and I think that the Western public opinion finally realized what Eastern Europeans knew for a very long time.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you on this. And this should have been obvious, I think, as early as 2008 when Putin ordered troops into Georgia and separated off South Ossetia and Abkhazia. And I'm not clear why successive administrations, I mean, I think that each of the last four administrations really has not had very clear eyes on Vladimir Putin. So this is not a Republican and Democrat thing. This is just a sort of a Western
absolutely
thing.
Agree.
Right?
Absolutely agree. From George W. Bush to Donald Trump via Barack Obama, all of them tried the same thing and failed in the same way. And they tried once again the same thing. From George W. Bush, who looked in Vladimir Putin's eyes and thought he saw his soul, To which Garry Kasparov said that Mr. Bush was wrong because Putin is KGB and they have no soul, to Barack Obama, who tried his infamous reset, to Donald Trump with his attempt to play nice with Vladimir Putin. All of them tried to kind of domesticate, not really to domesticate Vladimir Putin, but to play nice with him and to pray that everything will be fine. And that's even more the case with the Europeans. And the only explanation that I have for that was a denial and unwillingness to realize that some of the assumptions that we had about the world after the breakdown of communism were wrong, that history hasn't finished, as American philosopher Fukuyama claimed in 1989,
right,
that eventually we might need to fight in a kind of way that is disturbing, that we might have to bear some sacrifices and costs that are unpleasant, economic, political costs, that we will have to take some risks. So no politicians in a democracy like to admit, accept those facts. Now they have no choice, actually. Now Putin did something that no Western leader can really tolerate, and we've seen this tremendous turnaround in Western public opinion and some tectonic changes in European politics. I mean, Germany going from an uber-pacifist country in 48 hours to double its military budget and to cut off all economic and political ties with Russia. That's happened. History sped up more in 48 hours than in the previous 3 years in Europe. Those costs, they cannot avoid admitting that you have to deal with Vladimir Putin, and there are no easy ways of accommodating Russia.
And again, we're speaking with Dr. Ivan Yankovits, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Dr. Yankovits, I mean, I think it's impressive, right, the way that the West has come together. I believe it took Vladimir Putin by surprise. I think that he thought that his ability to addict Europe to Russian energy, plus the clear reluctance of Western democracies to grasp that there was a security crisis brewing. I think that he counted on all of that, and especially maybe after the 2014 seizure of Crimea and Donetsk and Luhansk, that he just thought that they would just fold and throw in the towel and hope that he would stop at Ukraine. That's clearly not now the case. Is it enough at this point what the West is doing?
Yeah. It is way more than I have expected. Essentially, I think that people either in the West or in Russia have not fully absorbed the historical significance of what had happened right now. Russia had gone in a short period of 48 to 72 hours last weekend from being a relatively well-integrated and semi-prosperous world power to being essentially North Korea. Russia is now completely shut off from the Western world financially, economically, in every other respect. Russia is now, by the hour, going back to the Soviet, to the old Soviet system. Right. Russian economy is going to be absolutely devastated by those sanctions. This will be Putin will react to that by cranking up political oppression. He's already making it very difficult for Russian citizens to flee the country. Probably in due course, he will completely close the borders, as his idols Andropov and Chernenko and communist leaders did in 1960s, 70s, and 80s. So Russia will become, if Putin is not removed from power, it will become just a pathetic client state of China, in the same way Belarus is now a client state of Russia. So that's the trajectory, historical trajectory of Russia. That's a historical change that has taken place in 3 or 4 days. In the Western world, I was pleasantly surprised how united it became very quickly, and even more so to what extent the Europeans had taken over the leading role in this crisis. That's something that I could have never predicted before, that the Germany and the continental European powers will take such a strong stance towards Putin, both in economic sanctions that are unprecedented. We can talk about that, the details about this. This is an economic equivalent of a nuclear warfare economics. What is being done to Russia right now is just an economic devastation. There is no other way to describe it.
Dr. Ivan Yankovits, I want to get another call in here, but that I was leading to the economic sanctions. I really want to go over that. But before we go there, let's go to Roy in Madison, who has a question for you. Roy, welcome to the conversation. Roy, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. My question is two questions. My grandkids are concerned in their Catholic school that this will become World War III, and it'll be nuclear, and it'll be end of our planet in 20 minutes. And my second question, do you think that the people inside Russia will be able to get him out, much like they tried to get Hitler? And that was what I was wondering, the two questions, please.
Roy, thank you so much for your call. And first off, question of going nuclear, and then after that, you know, what's kind of been called the Stauffenberg option, which is dangerous, a little bit dangerous talk, but I mean, certainly something we can discuss. Dr. Yankovic?
Let me start with the first question first. So what do you guys hear in terms of all the comments about the nuclear war and whatever? I'll give you a very brief version of what I think is going on. But this was a very cheap bluff from the part of Vladimir Putin that was ignored by the Western world. Essentially, I can tell you this, increasing the degree of preparedness or increasing the putting nuclear forces on high alert, that's something that Vladimir Putin said in 2014 he would do when asked what if the Western countries impose harsh sanctions on him, what he will do in response. And he said, I would increase the nuclear high alert. So that was intended to be a technique of intimidation. They didn't work, essentially. 2 hours later, when Putin pronounced this or announced this high nuclear alert, the president of the European Commission made a speech or a press conference saying that we are increasing our supplies of weapons to Ukraine. So nobody took it seriously. So that was just cheap and unsuccessful stunt by Vladimir Putin. And the second question, so there is zero chance that there will be a nuclear war because Putin is very well aware that nobody can win nuclear war, that both Russia and the entire world would be obliterated, and it's not just one madman who would press the button. It doesn't work that way. There are 5 or 10 other people who would need to carry out that order. So that's something that we shouldn't be thinking very much about. The risk of a nuclear war, in my view, is zero. The second question, go ahead.
No, I was just going to bring it around to the second question. How long before these sanctions bite, before others in the Russian political world decide that they've had enough of Vladimir Putin? I mean, that's sort of the traditional way out of these things.
Yeah, I'll tell you one personal note here. I was born and raised in Serbia. That's a small country in what was former Yugoslavia, and I grew up in the conditions that are very similar to the conditions in which Russia finds itself right now. Under Slobodan Milosevic, a Serbian dictator in the early 1990s, we were under a similar kind of sanctions in the early 90s. He survived for 6 or 7 years after that. However, I don't think that would work in Russia because we were a very poor country at that time. Sanctions hurt us, but we were not like a modern Russia. So you go from living in New York one day going back to Stone Age the next day. So that's the cultural and economic shock of Russians who were suddenly shut off from the entire civilized world will be so tremendous that the reaction will be much stronger than it was in Serbia in the 1990s. It's difficult to predict. Russia, Vladimir Karamurza, one of the very thoughtful Russian politicians, one of the leaders of Russian opposition, says that you have never assumed that the Russian government is completely stable, that some of the biggest revolutions and political changes in Russia has taken place literally over time, literally in 1 or 2 days. I tell you just one thing, how worried people around Putin are. The best testimony to that is today's statement by Dmitry Peskov, his spokesman, who said that all of us have to unite around President Putin right now. So the very need for him to say something like that tells you how much they're worried. And just one more indication how fragile this coalition around Putin is getting, that it seems that the American government so thoroughly penetrated in terms of intelligence the Russian government that we literally have the reports about Putin's behavior and his mood and everything else on a daily basis. And the American government is sharing that with our public. We had every Russian tactical military plan, our government had it almost in real time. You cannot have that level of granularity of intelligence if you don't have the sources that are really, really, really high up. That tells you that some people around Putin are very nervous and that they're very dissatisfied, and that some of them or many of them are working, are willing to work with the Western government. That tells you that this stability, political stability of Putin's position is much weaker now than it was 2 or 3 months ago.
And Dr. Yankovitz, I mean, part of this is the economic sanctions that have been applied. And this is where I did want to get to this, because these really are, this is economic warfare. There's no other way of putting this. Russia's trying to conduct it, and also trying to conduct it. They're not succeeding. They've had to shut down their market all week long. The Russian firms' shares trading on other exchanges are worthless at this point of time. This is a devastating strike on their economy.
I'm just looking at the ruble today. It lost like 15-20% additionally as compared to yesterday. On Western stock markets, their leading banks and firms were listed in the days after the sanctions were imposed. Their stock market lost like 97-98% in a few days. So essentially evaporated, like $600 billion of value just evaporated from the assets of Russian firms and banks. And that's just the beginning. The real problem here for the Russian government is twofold. First, what they thought was their war chest, this $630 billion worth of government savings that they thought they could use to prop up the ruble and finance war, is now shut down by those central banking sanctions by the Europeans and Americans. They cannot use that money. That means that the ruble could not be supported, that the inflation rate will be much higher, and they will not have a hard currency to either buy commodities in the West or to finance war inside. And even beyond that, even the commodities and things that are not explicitly covered by sanctions as of now, like oil and gas, actually. So the Western countries try to carve out the exceptions for that. The demand for them is plummeting. They have trouble, really cannot sell 70% of their oil supply right now. Although there are no formal sanctions, because nobody wants to touch anything Russian with a 6-foot pole.
Right.
So that's the problem. One American administration official says that private firms may even overreacting now to the sanctions. So you see the flight of Western companies as the British Petroleum, ExxonMobil, and Apple, Microsoft, IKEA, and everybody is leaving. So essentially, in a very short period of time, the Russian economy, as a market economy, will cease to exist. Even domestic manufacturing in Russia that grew significantly in the last few years will cease to exist, because they rely on the imported component parts and inputs that simply don't exist right now. Their airlines will be grounded in 2 or 3 weeks because Boeing and Airbus refuse to give them the manuals and spare parts, so they cannot maintain their airplanes. They will be all grounded, so you will have to travel via train or bus from Vladivostok to Moscow. So they're going there. I think one Russian economist whose paper I read, he says that the Russians are still not aware of what awaits them, what Putin has in store for them. That they are actually literally going there, not kind of metaphorically and in terms of hyperbole, literally they're going back to the Soviet-style economy. Now the people nostalgic for Soviet empire now will have a chance to experience the Soviet model of economic and political life, good and hard and directly.
Dr. Ivan Yankovitz, we're speaking with him, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Let's go to one more call, Joanne in Sauk Rapids, Minnesota. Welcome to the conversation.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My question, actually there's kind of a couple combined.
Probably going to need to make it narrow. We've only got a couple of minutes left, Joanne. So.
Okay, why isn't the Ukraine part of NATO? And why I see things on TV that Putin basically says Ukraine can't be part of NATO. Why should he have a say? And then my last little thing is, I don't understand. It's almost like abortion. Because Ukraine is not part of NATO, the rest of the world, yes, we're giving them supplies and things, but we're not physically helping them. It's like the baby in the womb and the baby outside the womb. And so I'm going to get off the phone and I'll let you answer.
Joanna's good call, good question. Yeah. Dr. Yankovitz, I mean, there's actually some realistic reasons why NATO didn't expand into Ukraine, partly because in 2014, Russia invaded Ukraine anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, the main reason was that actually Ukraine was never going to be, if Putin didn't do this madness. Eventually, now I'm certain that Ukraine will join the NATO in due course. Since 2007, 2008, the Ukraine and Georgia accession to NATO was off the table because Germany was against it. So NATO makes decisions by consensus. All 29 states have to agree about any further expansion of NATO. Germany was categorically against that because they have to develop their Ostpolitik, their good relationships with Russia. Angela Merkel was at the forefront of that. So there was no realistic possibility that Ukraine joins NATO anytime soon. And that was just an empty rhetorical trick, that propaganda trick that Putin was using. He knew perfectly well that there was no realistic chance of Ukraine joining the NATO. What worried him particularly was the dangerous precedent that the Ukraine sets for Russian citizens. You have to understand that Ukraine and Russia are two very close nations and two very close people who speak a very similar language. They are connected with family ties, with friendship ties. They travel between themselves. They're very intertwined, two very intertwined nations. And Putin was in mortal fear that this democratic experiment in Ukraine, that the government that respects the rule of law and market economy and is in friendly terms to its NATO neighbors, could give to Russian citizens some ideas about why wouldn't we have such a government in Russia? Why would we need to struggle under this oriental, despotic, tyrannical regime of Vladimir Putin? Why wouldn't we have a democracy just like our brothers and sisters and family members and relatives in Ukraine have? So that's the real problem for Vladimir Putin, that Ukraine is a big danger for his domestic political regime in Moscow. Not so much that he is worried about NATO expansion in Ukraine.
Indeed. And Dr. Ivan Yankovitz, thank you so much for being with us today, talking about Ukraine. Really quickly, though, before I let you go, there was one more question about the no-fly zone. And I mean, I think I'm going to answer it myself just briefly. The reason why you don't impose a no-fly zone is because it's an act of war. It's a great way to start World War III. Yeah. What are your thoughts on the no-fly zone?
Yeah, I agree absolutely. That's the very... I understand why people are emotional when they see those horrific images of Russian artillery shelling the civilian buildings in Kharkiv and Kiev, and that they feel need to do something, but that's not a way to help the Ukrainians. The way to help the Ukrainians is to give them the weapons to defend themselves, is for the American government to expedite the delivery of, for example, airplanes that could be given anti-tank weaponry, and airplanes, and to convince Poland, Slovakia, and Eastern European countries to give more of airplanes and other defensive systems like anti-aircraft systems to Ukraine. They will be capable of defending themselves very well. They don't need, if we provide them with a sufficient quantity and quality of weapons, they can defend themselves. They don't need our no-fly zone.
Yes, so they have
that's,
been...
That's both counterproductive and dangerous, because it would be essentially a World War III. We would be declaring war to Russia.
Indeed, and the Ukrainians have put up a courageous fight in their own self-defense. We should be supporting that.
Absolutely.
And Dr. Ivan Yankovitz, thank you so much for taking some time to talk about this with us. He's at the University of Mary in Bismarck, North Dakota. When we come back, we'll be talking with Alex Schadenberg, who heads up the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition based out of Ontario, talking about assisted suicide and the impact that has on other suicides. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.
Relevant Radio runs on horsepower, your horsepower. Donate any vehicle and keep your station running. Join in with thousands of other listeners who have given their unused vehicles at relevantradio.com/car.
All the issues, one place. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
It's 33 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of hotair.com, filling in for Drew, taking your calls at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Just heard Father Rocky's Lenten reflection of the day. It's beautiful. You can go to relevantradio.com to find more out about that, by the way, and we'll be talking a little bit about it in the middle of next hour as well, so stay tuned for that. Fascinating one today. Really enjoyed it. But before we go there, we're going to talk a little bit about a need for repentance on the part of people who have been pushing for assisted suicide, legalization of assisted suicide. New study has shown that it's far more dangerous than previously thought. Joining us here to discuss that is Alex Schadenberg. He heads up the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition based out of Ontario. He's been fighting against the assisted suicide and euthanasia push in Canada for many years now. You can find more out about that at epcc.ca. Alex, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's really good. You guys are always focusing on the issues and helping to inform people, and I'm glad to be with you.
Well, this is a really interesting development, and it's certainly one that a lot of the people like yourself, others who opposed these assisted suicide laws have been predicting all along, which is that when you pass these laws for assisted suicide, it's not just that, it doesn't just mean that people get provided assistance to commit suicide. It really starts to break down the social constructs against suicide that have existed to maintain, you know, life for the entire human project up until now.
Absolutely. So there was a study done that looked at the whole question. It was done by ethicist David Albert Jones out of the UK, and he's looking at the whole question of suicide in relation to countries that have legalized euthanasia or assisted suicide. Now, we already have seen this data before, but he really did put it together in an excellent study showing that where they've legalized euthanasia or assisted suicide, that the argument that suicides, you know, other suicides other than assisted suicide, that they would decrease is what the argument is by the pro-death side, but in fact they increase. Now, we've been seeing this for a long time. We've seen this data out of Oregon. Now, Oregon's not what you call a massive jurisdiction, so it's harder to, how would you say, relate to these numbers. But if you look at the Netherlands, right, and Belgium, you see that where they have euthanasia, been there for quite a few years, you see this increase in numbers. And what was very interesting about it is the increase in numbers of suicides actually affected women to a far greater extent than men, not to say that it didn't affect men, but the number of suicides for women was far greater in the increase once you've legalized euthanasia or assisted suicide than in relation to men. Because normally speaking, in a culture, the suicide rate for women tends to be much lower than the suicide rate for men. So this is what he looked at, and he sort of uncovers the fact that not only do the numbers go up, it's a greater effect on women than men.
A greater effect on women than men, and it is an effect that is independent of other cultural pressures. I mean, if you're looking at, you know, during the time period when these studies are taking place, I mean, this is prior to the, you know, the war in Ukraine, and obviously lots of political pressure in Europe and here too as well. I think it's mostly prior. I believe it was prior to the pandemic,
Some of that is prior to the pandemic. That's correct. Yes.
So when you have those situations,
what are you doing?
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Alex.
Yeah, so what he's actually doing is he's looking at the stats based on from the late 90s into over a 20-year period. So what you're seeing over that 20-year period, so let's say we're looking at Europe, where you have euthanasia legal in the Netherlands and Belgium and in Luxembourg, and assisted suicide is legal in Switzerland. If you look at those countries and you compare it to the rest of Europe, you actually notice that for the rest of Europe, the suicide rate has dropped. Now, there could be many reasons for that, but the suicide rates have actually gone down in the rest of Europe. But in those countries, the suicide rates have gone up. And we're talking about these suicide rates going up, even independent of the fact that you've legalized euthanasia and assisted suicide. And you know that, of course, is a form of hastening the death of these people.
Right.
What is significant about this is the argument. So, because the assisted suicide euthanasia lobby, they're always saying, well, by legalizing euthanasia, you're actually lessening those violent suicides because somebody who might be in great suffering can die by euthanasia or assisted suicide rather than take their own life. And in fact, if you look at the Supreme Court of Canada decision, that horrific decision that was made by the Supreme Court of Canada, which led to the legalization of euthanasia in Canada, that's one of the arguments that the Supreme Court accepted. They said, well, you know, you're actually protecting human life by legalizing euthanasia and assisted suicide, as crazy as that argument was, but that's what they said based on this false data. And what was nice about this this whole data is he's looking at all at those specific countries, and he specifically compares them to other similar nations, but nations that had not legalized, such as Germany had not legalized euthanasia, but the Netherlands has, etc. What's important about this also is in Oregon, we already saw this similar data come out several years ago, and the conclusion of a study showed that there was about a 6.7% increase in suicide in Oregon, and they would and they said that you can't directly link that to assisted suicide, but there is a correlation here, knowing that the suicide rates in the U.S. have gone up, but in Oregon it had gone up much faster, right? And that's how they,
right.
they looked at that data. And this shows that, of course, it's the same in Europe. Now, in Canada, we've only legalized since 2016, so I guess our data won't be conclusive yet.
Well, at least not in the same longitude, right? I mean, we're talking about a 20-year study as opposed to might be a 3 or 4 year study if you're going to try to get in ahead of the pandemic, right? Because you would expect pandemic to have pandemic isolation to introduce all sorts of different issues into mental health issues, and we're probably going to see as a result, if we haven't already seen, just an overall increase in suicides and mental health issues just as a result of the isolation. And that's the reason why I want to make sure that we're making sure people understand that the data that we're talking about in this study is a longitudinal study that goes for 2 decades and it ends prior to the pandemic isolation. So we're talking about data that is not involved in the war in Europe, not involved in pandemic isolation.
Correct. And I say also what's significant about it is when you're talking about issues like suicide, there's always other factors. So it's very difficult to say that there's a direct relationship. But when you're looking at 4 different countries and you're comparing the data to the rest of Europe and you're noticing that the trend remains identical in 4 different countries that have legalized as compared to the rest of Europe, now you can say more closely that there's a direct relationship between the two. Because obviously that is the difficulty with studying suicide. There's many factors that lead to suicide. Now, as for the other issue of the pandemic, there has been quite a few stories in Canada, as an example, where we've legalized euthanasia, where people have asked for euthanasia, not because they were terminally ill, not because they were physically suffering, but because they wanted to avoid the further lockdowns. So we saw several significant news articles about elderly people asking for euthanasia. In fact, the one elder expert out of British Columbia, which is on the West Coast, was concerned because there were several stories that had come out, and she was saying that she thought that the isolation was leading to more euthanasia deaths in British Columbia. So how much of a connection would be hard to know, but clearly these anecdotal stories would connect to the fact of isolation leading to more euthanasia.
Well, I think so. And again, we're speaking with Alex Schadenberg, and we're taking your calls at 888-914-9149 on the topic of euthanasia and assisted suicide. And I think when you're looking at this, the breadth of the data and the depth of the data really shows that there is a causal relationship, right? I mean, this is not
That's
just
correct.
A casual correlative impact. This is a causative relationship. I'm just going to read off a couple of points here for those who haven't read this. In one of the 4 jurisdictions, the Netherlands, which has the longest history and greatest number of deaths by euthanasia/assisted suicide in Europe, the rates of non-assisted suicide have increased since EAS was legalized by statute. This is both an increase in absolute terms and an increase relative to its only non-EAS neighbor, Germany. In another of the 4 jurisdictions, Belgium, which isn't far off from Germany, which has the second highest rate of death by EAS in Europe, While the rates of non-assisted suicide decreased in absolute terms, they increased relative to its most similar non-EAS neighbor, France. It is striking that Belgium now has the highest female non-assisted suicide rate in Europe based on OECD suicide data. And, I mean, these are clearly contraindications, right? These are not just statistical anomalies. These are significant findings in the statistics.
Right, these are significant findings because it's consistent throughout all four nations that had legalized, and in comparison to other nations that had not legalized, you see that that it's direct. And the fact of it also is which is not the same as in America. In Europe, they have seen a lower suicide rate in the last 20 years, so it's been a lessening of the suicide rate. But in countries that have legalized, it's an increase in the suicide rate that's been occurring. And the prime example is referring to, like, Switzerland. The clear increase of Swiss women's, the suicide rate for Swiss women as compared to the rest of Europe was actually, in fact, quite shocking when you looked at it, because not only Swiss, but the other ones, but there was a clear indication in Switzerland of an increase in the suicide rate amongst women. And as I've already said, what's significant about that is the fact that women tend to have a lower suicide rate. And yet you see this jump up going up in these nations that have legalized.
And Belgium had the highest suicide rate among women of any country in Europe and by 2016. 8.8 deaths per 100,000. The UK was 3.3. New Zealand and Australia was 6.1 and 6.0. But, I mean, that's 8.8 as compared to, you know, 3.3 for the United Kingdom. That's a huge difference in terms of statistics and population.
Yeah, so right now it's actually significant to talk about this also because there's been a big push right now in the U.S. to legalize assisted suicide. So right now there's a big debate going on in Connecticut. So Connecticut has defeated assisted suicide bill after assisted suicide bill. Connecticut's one of those states where every year you can count on an assisted suicide bill being introduced. And somehow they've been able to defeat it every year in Connecticut. And once again, they're debating assisted suicide. You've got quite a few states now that have assisted suicide bills being debated, and there's a big push now with court cases. And so this whole lie about, oh, you know, assisted suicide, it's all about providing, you know, a death with dignity, which is another lie we can go into. That's a whole another program. But, you know, they use this argument. And, you know, I'll give you one other example to show you how crazy it is. During the Canadian Senate, when they were debating the expansion of euthanasia last spring, the one senator who's a psychiatrist came out and he was attacking the suicide prevention people who were against the expansion of euthanasia. And he was saying, well, why would you be all so upset knowing that you have a lesser suicide rate when you legalize euthanasia, which, of course, was a lie. The data is quite clearly on the opposite side. So this is how deeply the lie is being spread, that someone who's a psychiatrist and a senator would actually make such a crazy statement and think it's true.
We're speaking with Alex Schadenberg at EPPC.ca regarding
EPCC.ca. Yeah.
You know, I know I was going to do that, Alex. EPCC.ca.
It's all good. Yeah, it's all good.
I knew I was going to do that. We're talking about assisted suicide, euthanasia, the impact it has on people in the cultures where it is adopted. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about dignity of life, because I think that's still worth pursuing, even if it's a little bit more brief. But also, the idea of suicide contagion. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio. Faith over fear.
It's 50 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today, taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We are speaking with Alex Schadenberg of the Euthanasia Prevention Coalition based out of Ontario. That's EPCC.ca. EPCC.ca.
Sure.
Alex.
Perfect, yeah.
There you go. See, I knew I could. You have to stick the landing, Alex. That's what you have to do. You have to stick the landing on these things.
Good. Excellent.
So we're talking about the rise in suicides that surround legalized assisted suicide. And I think it's fair to ask, and I know that in an interview that he did with Mercator, that David Albert Jones, who did this study, was asked about suicide contagion. And you know, he was saying, no, you know, my role here is to drill into the data, not to tell you the why. But I think you and I can discuss the why, because this is something that we have said for quite some time, that when you legalize things like this, you are conferring some sort of social recognition on that, and it helps to break down whatever taboos are in that cultures have put in place in order to keep people from taking their own lives.
Yes. Now, the other thing is how assisted suicide is sold to the culture, because, you know, when somebody dies by assisted suicide, it's often promoted as being heroic. You know, they did this, they took their life into their own, you know, hands. They chose freedom, you know. It's all sold as a wonderful thing, and isn't this great that they had the right to do this? And so then the question comes up, well, how can you prevent suicide when it's promoted as heroic, if it's so heroic? You know, and this is where it comes down to what makes it different, because someone might have a health condition as compared to someone who's got a mental health condition. And this is what we're actually facing in nations that have legalized euthanasia. So if you consider the whole question of the issue of mental health as compared to physical health, in the places like the Netherlands and Belgium, they allow euthanasia for reasons of mental illness. And the reason is, as they say, well, it's suffering. It's suffering. It's suffering. So when you're saying that the answer to mental health conditions and the answer to physical suffering is lethal drugs, then why would there be then a reason to say there's something wrong with suicide itself? And this is what's happening within the culture. You lose that. Yeah? You lose that whole frame of mind that there's something wrong in a culture that abandons people. And this is what we're doing. We're abandoning people to their death. The further thing with the whole thing is there's like a social contract, and you already referred to it as we have this whole concept that there's something wrong with suicide itself. So that's that suicide taboo. But, you know, the euthanasia lobby, the assisted suicide lobby, they're actually promoting suicide. Their philosophy is that you should be able to die at the time of your choosing. And so, therefore, that completely undermines it. So you see that in the Netherlands also, where what's the big political debate right now? The big political debate, other than child euthanasia, which is also a political debate in the Netherlands, is this whole thing about tired of living. So the argument that they're making in the Netherlands is that when you turn a certain age and you feel you might not be terminally ill, you might not have any illness at all, but you feel that your life is complete, you should be able to just go and receive your lethal drugs and to die. Tired of living is the concept. This is very nihilistic if you think about it. It's actually, you know, it's anti-human because of the fact, you know, we all go through difficult times in our existence. And it's possible that someone who's elderly may have lost their spouse, possibly they are alone because they don't have kids or family living nearby, etc. It's possible that they might feel that they want to end their life, but that isn't something that we should be, how would you say, legalizing, encouraging, and making a reality. That is the question, is how do you properly care for these people? You know, and this is the whole thing that comes down to. My final point is the whole thing of euthanasia and assisted suicide is anti-human in and of itself, not only because we're killing people, but because we're abandoning people at their time of need. It's normal for a person who's going through health conditions. It's normal for a person who might be alone or lonely or feeling like a loss of hope or a loss of purpose. It's normal for that person within the human condition to possibly feel that, why am I still alive? What's my purpose? I'm not saying that this is a wonderful thing. I'm saying it's a normal human reality. The response to this is to care for that person, to help them find meaning, help them find hope, to share faith with them, to care for them. That's the response. But the response by the euthanasia and assisted suicide lobby is they should have lethal drugs. Well, you can see how that totally changes the attitude of what it means to be human. And you can see how the suicide rate in that type of a culture only goes up.
Well, I think what it does is it really just reduces humanity to utilitarian value. And especially correct. This whole, I mean, this is part of the whole issue with euthanasia as well as assisted suicide, as well as abortion, is that you are treating humanity as though the only value it has is what can be gleaned at present in terms of some sort of production, whether it's emotional production, whether it's labor production, whether it's familial guidance production, and that's the entirety of its value. And when you do that, then some of these things make sense if you do that. But the problem is that it misses what it means to be human. It reduces us to our animal monetary value, if you will.
Right. And I always say that it's very difficult because as a human being, we are a unified being. We're not dualistic or we're not a separated being. We're emotional, we're psychological, we're spiritual, we're physical, and we're all interconnected. So in that nature, if someone is feeling down or emotionally distraught or having these deep feelings of hopelessness, these are things that are now going to go deep into their psyche. It's the nature of what makes us human. That's why it's so important that we recognize the interconnectedness of the human person, that I am part of my life is to be with you and you to be with me, that's how we're created to be. We're created to be in community and to share community and to care for each other. That's how we're created to be. So when we separate ourselves from that, then, of course, euthanasia thrives and suicide thrives. I was just reading an article just a minute ago, but from the euthanasia lobby. I shouldn't read this stuff because it's pretty bad. And they're providing information on how you can properly kill yourself. And this is an article. I'm not going to send it out to anybody because, obviously speaking, I don't want someone thinking it's a good idea to follow the rules that they're showing on how to do this. But what I'm getting down to is the fact that this is the nihilistic attitude of the euthanasia-assisted suicide lobby, that not only are some lives not worth living, but, we're going to abandon you in your time of need. We're not going to recognize the fact that we all need each other. We're going to, either help you or we're actually going to kill you when the time is where you feel that your life has lost purpose or value. That is a culture I don't want to have anything to do with, and that's the culture that is far more becoming relevant in our culture, and I wish it weren't there. So when it goes back to suicide, it's obvious that when you've got a culture like that, the suicide rate is going up, because we're losing our purpose and what it means to be human.
Indeed. We're speaking with Alex Schadenberg. Let's take a quick call from William in St. Louis. William, we've got about a minute and a half left.
Well, I'll make it very brief. I just wanted to tell you what I told the screener. I debated this issue with one of the euthanasia proponents. His name was Peter Singer.
Yep.
In social work journals. And what you will find is that these Europeans that started this are extremely right-wing politically. Then they come to states like Oregon and trick the legislators into passing these laws, and Connecticut should vote it down every time, I hope.
William, thank you very much for your call. I'm not necessarily thinking that this is entirely a right-left issue. I think that there's people on both sides of the or across the spectrum that get into this. Alex, we've got about 30 seconds. Why don't you respond to that, and we'll wrap up.
I'm just going to say that the thing about euthanasia is suicide. It's not right or left, but it really does demean what it means to be human, because it's saying that when I'm in my time of need, that yes, it's better that I be dead than to live. It's better to end my life than to be cared for.
Yeah, I always find that the political spectrum is sort of like a donut more than a line. So a lot of times when you have people on the extreme left and the extreme right, they end up pretty close to the same spot. Alex Schadenberg, EPCC.ca, EPCC.ca. William, thank you for your call.
Much.
Thank you, Alex, for being with us. Coming up next is the Chaplet of Divine Mercy. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. We'll be right back.